Please keep in mind, the views expressed on the Thin Men podcast reflect those of the hosts and the hosts alone. They are not necessarily representative of the Myrna Loy Center or its staff. Thank you. And we're back. Welcome to the Thin Men. I'm Zach.
And I'm Biggs.
It is so nice to be back. I hope everyone listening had a great holiday and a happy new year.
So we're going to be changing how this comes out to you. It will be out every other Wednesday from now on. We're just going to try and make sure we've got the highest quality caliber of podcast we can.
So that's right. You don't want our tired voices bringing your day down. You want us perky and upright and ready to roll.
That's right. So we'll be doing this every other week just to make sure we've got the highest content that we can possibly deliver.
Exactly. And not at all because we have busy real lives.
So today we're doing a review of Whiplash, which is playing at the Myrna Loy right now.
That's right. Directed by a first-time filmmaker named Damien Chazelle.
And then we'll also be discussing Zach and I's combined top 10 list.
So that's right.
We'll get into that a little bit more.
There was some haggling. I think people are going to have fun with this.
Yeah. So without delay, here we go. It's just playing at the Myrna Loy right now.
I have to say, this is going to be a fun little review, especially for me, because I've now seen it probably 3 weeks ago, and I've just been living in this film. And Big saw it for the first time recently, so you're going to get a little more a perspective from time gone by and a fresh perspective.
I was excited to see this because I used to drum. I love jazz, and I love J.K. Simmons, quite frankly.
Yes. So
you put those three things together, this was pretty much a could-not-miss movie for me.
Absolutely.
But I would like to think it's a could-not-miss movie for a lot of people.
If it has been a can-miss movie for people out there, that needs to change. Because the thing that's in common from the time-worn perspective and the new perspective is it's a really, really great film.
Yeah, so as we're talking about this, the Academy Award nomination should be out. Keep in mind when I say that I will be utterly shocked if this doesn't get some nominations, please understand that I've not seen the list yet.
I can guarantee at least one nomination.
So what would you think it would be nominated for?
So the one I'll guarantee is J.K. Simmons for Best Supporting Actor.
I would agree.
Yeah, that is, I mean,
in fact, I think, I know he's a supporting actor, but you could almost make a case for him being Best Actor as well.
It really is a co-lead film.
Yeah.
It just comes down to where they felt was best to nominate him. And so here's something interesting. He, J.K. Simmons in Whiplash and Steve Carell in the upcoming Foxcatcher have almost identical percentages of screen time in their film. But Steve Carell is eligible for the lead actor category and J.K. Simmons is eligible for the supporting actor category.
Now, how did they separate that? Do we know?
It's super nebulous. So there's a range of percentages of screen time where it's pretty clear that you're either supporting or a lead. However, there's this nebulous percentage from around probably 40% of the film's screen time to 60% of the film's screen time where it really can go either way.
Those things are always dicey anyway, though.
Yeah.
Like the classic example is Marlon Brando winning Best Actor. Mm-hmm. Al Pacino was up for Best Supporting Actor, but Pacino had more screen time.
Yes.
So it's, you know.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it really comes down to A, the nomination committee's general whim one way or another. There is a bit of like how important the character is to the story and in relation with the other characters. So
it's somewhat subjective.
Exactly. So like in Foxcatcher, the plot drives a lot from the Steve Carell character. In this film, the J.K. Simmons character is very much there as a piece of the Miles Teller character's story. And it's a very large piece, but
that's fair.
I think that's the distinction in this case.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
in an interesting, I think this is a film that could definitely sneak in a nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. That's where films like this, these smaller indies, tend to get their love, is in the nomination in the writing category. An interesting thing, Whiplash is not really based on anything, despite being eligible for adapted screenplay and not original. And the reason that is the film was written first as a feature-length screenplay. It didn't get any buyers, he couldn't find anyone to finance it, so he made it as a short film and submitted it to Sundance, where it just blew up. People loved it. It became part of that year's Sundance short film tour.
Now, did it have the same cast when it was a short?
Not the same cast, no.
Okay.
And some of the actors in the cast, some of the smaller people who are like in the band and whatnot, pop up again. But the two leads are new.
And the two leads are amazing.
The heart of the film. They're incredible. So the reason this one's eligible for adapted is so he creates the short film that gets attention and that gets a buyer who wants to finance the feature length version. So for Oscar purposes, this is a feature length film based on a short film. Hence the adapted screenplay, despite the fact that the short film was adapted from the very screenplay that was used to shoot the feature film.
Now, an interesting thing with this is I could definitely see it being up for Best Picture. But
I can see that too.
But just because of the way that Hollywood works, who knows?
Yeah, that can really go either way. I do think if it gets nominated for Best Picture, it doesn't have a shot of winning.
No,
it's just too small a film.
Yeah, and they tend to like to reward people who've done some things.
Exactly, they have a bit of a track record. But man, what a coup it would be to be in that group as like the eighth or ninth film in the list.
So essentially, this movie is about the main character, Heller.
Andrew. Is his name.
Oh, Andrew.
Yeah,
Teller.
Played by Miles Teller.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay. He's a jazz drummer. He's a 19-year-old kid. He's going to this school. Now, is this a fictional school? I feel like it's fictional. I've never heard of it before.
I feel like it's fictional as well, but I don't know enough about prestigious jazz band academies to really say for sure.
I mean, when he said it was the best school, the first thing I thought of was Juilliard immediately.
Yeah, I was like, well, for music, it's either Juilliard too. Or Berkeley.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably fake, but
yeah,
not really important.
But definitely based off either a real place or a medley of real places.
Yeah. Now, you can tell whoever wrote this film definitely put in some time in a band.
Damien Chazelle, he based the idea for the film off a relationship he had with his band teacher in middle school and high school who terrified him.
Now, what was the name of this director?
Damien Chazelle.
Okay, so yep. It is the same guy.
Yeah, same guy.
Yeah, and so that's another thing I wanted to say, having played music, when I watch this movie, there's a lot of little tells in there that I think if you play music, you pick up on, that maybe somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience with music won't pick up on. Like, seeing how intense J.K. Simmons is as a teacher, there were certain scenes where our protagonist would miss just the smallest little beat, and mm-hmm. I'd be like, oh no, because you just know the abuse is coming.
It's just about to break out. People should know that this can be a sort of emotionally harsh film, especially considering the type of character J.K. Simmons plays.
Yeah, and if you're familiar with Oz, you know what type of character he can play, because
yes.
He's not all that far off of it.
No,
in terms of how he lashes out angrily at
exactly
people.
It's that same explosive energy he brought to Oz as he's bringing to this performance.
Yeah, so this movie, the main character, he's a drummer. He wants to break in. He wants to be the best ever.
He wants to be the greatest jazz drummer in the history of jazz drummer. He talks a lot about how drummers in rock bands are just people who couldn't cut it. Like, it's not enough for him to be very good or find some level of greatness in another field. He wants to be the best jazz drummer.
And there's definitely a level of arrogance to him.
Absolutely. And it's the sort of arrogance that you get out of super competitive, hyper-driven people. Like, it's that Michael Jordan, Peyton Manning, Tom Brady arrogance.
Yeah, type A personality.
Exactly.
Sure.
That you are so fixated on your goal that anything that gets in the way is competition or a wall that needs to be destroyed.
J.K. Simmons is also that type of person.
Yes.
But one person is holding the baton and the other is not.
Yes.
Figurative baton. I don't
yes.
think he ever actually holds a baton. But
no, he uses his pure fingers and fists.
Yeah, he definitely uses his fists.
Oh, yes.
So we start out by seeing our main character. He's basically just practicing, playing in a space. And he's playing in the space where, I guess, like the best band plays. And J.K. Simmons comes walking up. and sees him playing, and he immediately goes like, oh, I'm sorry. And he says, no, you know who I am, right? Uh-huh. And he says, yeah. And he says, well, you know, we're looking for people.
Yeah. And he goes, why'd you stop playing? Mm-hmm. So the kid starts up again and immediately goes, so wait, I say, why'd you stop playing? And your answer to that question is to start playing like a wind up monkey. Like he, from the beginning, you can see sort of this driving hostility from the J.K. Simmons character.
Yes. He's very hostile.
Terrence Fletcher is his name, which is a great character name. Terrence yeah. Fletcher is an all time great name and I will never forget it.
Yeah, he's playing and I mean I'm watching, I'm like, wow, this guy is good. And then immediately, like, he looks up because he looks at the floor all the time. Mm-hmm. And he looks up and J.K. Simmons is gone, and so he just assumes that he didn't like what he heard. Mm-hmm. But then they have a rehearsal later and J.K. Simmons walks into the class and
auditions everybody.
Yep. And just immediately picks him.
Yes. There's a great moment. He's sort of throughout the movie, the Miles Teller character has this rivalry with the band guy who was ahead of him in the lower class, the drummer who was ahead of him. And there's a moment where J.K. Simmons goes, drums, come with me. And this older drummer gets up and starts walking. He's like, no, not you. Other drums.
Yeah.
And you just see
doesn't
like
doesn't even use his name, just other drums.
Other drums.
So for people who aren't so initiated, you could make a case that J.K. Simmons and how he leads a band is essentially Miles Davis. I mean, you really could make that case. There's other guys you could fit in there, mm-hmm. but very much Miles Davis. Like, Miles Davis was notorious for just doing anything it took to get people to play the notes that he wanted them to play, up to striking people in practices. Yeah. Which, I mean, you can see in the trailer, so I don't think it's any surprise when you watch
the movie. That this guy is not the nicest man in the world.
Yeah, but Miles Davis was infamous for this. And people who gained his respect kept his respect. His most famous saxophone player that he ever played with was John Coltrane, like an absolute legend. So the way that he handled John Coltrane was he would go and he would find the best saxophone player he could to play with with him in the band to keep him on his toes and make sure he was playing really well. So the most famous Miles Davis album and the best-selling album is A Kind of Blue. Mm-hmm. And he had Cannonball Adderley playing saxophone on that. He was also a great saxophone player in his own right, but he solely existed in the sextet just to make sure that John Coltrane kept pushing himself as hard as he could. So there's a lot of shades of Miles Davis in this character that J.K. Simmons is portraying. And he does a great job. I mean, you really believe that this guy cares about his music. You really believe that he will do anything and push to any limits to get greatness out of somebody.
He believes the same thing that, like, the greatest football coaches and the greatest drill sergeants believe.
Yeah.
Which is that if you coddle anyone even for a moment, you're encouraging weakness in them.
Yeah, he has a line in the movie which really stayed with me.
The two most harmful words in the English language are good job.
If you just relax, you're never pushing the boundaries of what you can do.
In a way, it's almost the thesis statement of the movie.
Yes.
It's essentially if you take nothing else from the movie, take that. Now, there's a lot, and this is what I think makes it a great movie, is there's a lot of debate to be had about whether the pursuit of that technique and whether that end justifies the means of how Terrence Fletcher chases these people and tries to push them up and tries to inspire them and tries to drain the best out of them, like someone twisting a sponge to get all the water out.
You definitely see at the end of the movie, which I won't spoil, an alternative way to bring out the best in people.
Yes.
And so it is presented at the end. And I would think it would be a better way.
And man, I wish we could talk more about the ending without giving it away. If only because the thing you're talking about is what...
It's a final performance. That's not a surprise in a movie about music.
It's almost like I actually was sort of making a lot of parallels between this movie and a sports movie. Like, in a lot of ways, this is a truly great sports movie. And much like a great sports movie ends with the big game, this ends with the big show.
And there's definitely a lot of blood in this movie.
A ton of blood.
Okay, so the character pushes himself so hard multiple times that you're seeing blood coming out of his calluses, like all over his drum head, all over his sticks. Mm-hmm. It happens multiple times. There's another situation that happens where you definitely see a lot of blood coming from his body as he's playing. But this is another way where you can really tell if you play music, the director really has a love of music and has been there.
Yes, absolutely.
I can tell you from having played drums, if you play hard for for a while, you're going to bleed. And you just got to play through it because eventually your hands callous up. And you're capable of doing more, but you cannot get to that point if you don't create those calluses in the first place.
Absolutely.
You know,
it's worth noting that Miles Teller, in the scenes where you see the blood sort of coming out of his hands, there's a lot of close-ups where you see it sort of like going out of his fingers and watching a drop fall onto the drum head. And that's his blood. He really did, much like his character, push himself to that point where he was physically breaking apart.
And I'm going to tell you, if you start playing as fast as he plays, and you've never played that fast before, or you're not used to playing that fast, you're going to get blood coming from those hands. Mm-hmm. Like, people draw the symbolism from it in the movie, and there's a measure of that, but there's reality grounded into it too. You will bleed all over if you do this.
Now, to make the bloodiness even more upsetting, so Miles Teller really did, in the work he did to put this performance on screen, to embody a lot of the characteristics of his character. The director, Damien Chazelle, embodied a lot of the characteristics of Terrence Fletcher throughout the process. Namely in that one of his tricks he would use to get those just utterly exhausted, drooping shots of Miles Teller, like soaked in sweat, his clothes completely wet, slumped over, like barely able to keep sitting up. What he would do during scenes is when the scene ended, he wouldn't say cut. And he would just make Miles Teller keep drumming and keep drumming and keep drumming until he felt like calling cut. It's that kind of dedication that A, you need to make something like this, and B, the good job thesis statement doesn't work if the director isn't willing to show that same devotion in making the film with that thesis statement.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, and it's all about that pushing yourself for greatness. And that's what this movie really is. I mean,
absolutely.
This character is pushing himself to be better every day. Nothing in his life can compare to this. And we get a little hint of why he's so driven, which I would say for a lot of artists, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be music, but a lot of people feel this way. I mean, there's a lot of tortured relationships with parents, and you know, you see why people are craving that attention, that attention for why other people think they're great, like strangers, why they would care if strangers think they're great. You know, like, I know there's a thing in this country about becoming famous at, you know, for whatever, like people don't even think about why they want to be famous. They just want to be famous, but it's for that driven person with that one particular thing. There's usually something in their past, like maybe inattention, which is the case in this movie, just malaise from your parental figures. And that's definitely present in this. And his father, played by Paul Reiser, who I haven't seen for a while.
He sort of fell off the map. I think he was on a TV show I didn't watch.
Yes. Well, he was on a couple over the years.
Yeah. I mean, recently, I think he was on a TV show I didn't watch. He's been on a lot of TV shows I didn't watch.
Me too. He was on a couple that I watched when I was a kid, but you know, that's neither here nor there. But Paul Reiser does a really good job because he's got, how can I put it? There's this little thread of passive aggressive going through him.
There is.
Just ever so slightly.
He really brings three key traits in that mix well. The passive aggressiveness you mentioned, and he mixes that with not neglect so much as an almost indifference to his son's passion, while also being so earnestly loving towards him and protective towards him.
When we get to the point where we do see the love coming from the father, the son had to earn it hard. He earned it in the way that he didn't want to earn it. If that may,
like, sure.
And I'm trying not to be too specific here, but it was not the way that the son wanted to get his father's attention.
Yeah, it is worth noting they are not estranged. They're still very close. Like Miles Teller mentions, like, he still goes to the movies with his dad every week. Like, they do have a closeness. You can just tell they're not people who would probably have any relationship with one another if not for the fact that they're family.
Yeah, like, there's this one little scene that I think says a lot about it. When they go to a movie together and they're eating popcorn and the son, like, dumps in all these raisinettes in it, and he's eating around the raisinettes, and the dad's like, did you want a raisinette? And he's like, no, I don't like those. Like,
yeah.
He's like, well, why don't you just say something? He's like, well, I just eat around it. And he's like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And it's like, you can tell he just wants his dad to, like, be happy and like him.
Yeah.
And love him, you know? And it's just, it's all said in that little scene. I mean, his dad just doesn't understand his way of doing it. And the one thing that he's passionate about and aggressive about, his dad just doesn't really care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's definitely a strained father-son relationship going into this, which, once again, if you know musicians, that's so accurate. Stand-up comedians, musicians, painters, so many people have these strained relationships that that drive them to create art. I'm sorry that I'm going off on this, but it's just like, it's very rare that you see movies, like, let's just focus on music for a second. It's so rare to see movies about music where they actually focus on those little details that make people. They're usually more concerned with the love relationship, which is in here, but it's such
It's done in a very, and that's actually something I wanted to talk about in a little bit. Mainly,
now's a good time. I mean,
there is a lot of, so we are making this movie sound very dark, and it is dark, to some extent, but there is some lightness in it. And it is with this love plot that first is very funny and like a sweet, cute, charming sort of like two awkward young people finding each other. It's very sweet. And then there are scenes later, as we sort of see the course of their relationship, and this is a very minor part of the film, but then it brings a little bit of comedy in the same way Freaks and Geeks did, where you're just cringing so hard at the decisions they're making. But it's funny. Like, it's not laugh riot funny, but it's funny in the way a satire is funny. And then there's a lot of great physical comedy, both with him and the girl, where he's just so physically awkward within himself. Like, much like you see a great swimmer just seems awkward out of a pool, he seems awkward whenever he's not behind a drum set. And then there's physical comedy. Like, there's a scene where J.K. Simmons leans over the drums to try to say something to him, and he smacks the crash cymbal, and the other side hits J.K. Simmons in the jaw. So there is lightness to be found in this movie.
Yeah, there's little moments, but it's definitely an intense movie.
Intense is the best way to describe it.
Yeah, I was telling you earlier, it reminds me of when we used to watch Breaking Bad, especially in the final season, because I would go through and I would not breathe for like 20 solid minutes.
You wouldn't realize it.
Yeah.
Like, the commercial break or the credits, and very much in this case, the film credits come, and you just release this pressure of air like you're turning on a gas tank. And it's just like, oh, I wasn't breathing that whole time.
Yeah. And this movie never lets you off easy either. No. I got to say, I mean, like, it's like a pressure cooker at the beginning, and it only builds.
Yeah.
Even to the final scene, when you get some levity at the end, I mean, it's still, it doesn't vent all the pressure at the end.
Not at
like
all.
I can't help but wonder what happens after that moment.
And that's something I wish we could talk about more, because I have a lot of thoughts about that ending that are hard to get into without giving it away.
Yeah.
So if anyone wants to come by the Myrna and talk to me about it, I gladly will. Because I'll talk about this movie all day. It's worth noting, for as little as we're talking about it, the last 10 or 15 minutes or so from the scene in the jazz bar on through the big game performance are just magnetic. It is impossible to tear your eyes off the screen for a moment during that stretch run of the film.
They replay a lot of the same songs over and over again because, as anybody knows who's played in a band, you have to get stuff tight.
You play everything a million times.
Yeah, so it's not something where they throw like 14 songs at you. You probably only hear like 3 or 4 songs in the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And then it's like quick sections done over and over again, but you hear like maybe 2 songs to completion, and they're fantastic.
They are.
The music choices that they picked are really, really well done. So if you're a fan of jazz, I really recommend this too.
This is a movie that is very much aware of itself and what it's trying to accomplish, aware of the world it's building and the world it's inhabiting, namely that world of jazz heads and intense musicians. And that awareness really shines through. Like, this is the work, because there are little hiccups and little directorial things that are the sort of things that happen when you have a first-time filmmaker, but you so rarely see the awareness come through in a first-time filmmaker's film, where every decision seems sure-handed and for a reason and thought out. It's an incredible achievement for everyone involved, really.
And once again, I want to say, J.K. Simmons, this was the performance of a lifetime for him.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, I think if this movie gets some traction, this will be what he's remembered for, first and foremost.
And this is the kind of thing any actor would love to be remembered for. Like, the work he does here, it really makes people who are maybe only cursory familiar with him from sort of seeing him.
You know him.
Or, yeah,
you may
know
not
him.
Be familiar of the name, but you know him. I mean, the guy played J. Jonah Jameson in Spider-Man. He's in the Farmers commercial.
Exactly.
Been a character actor forever. Just been so many tiny little scenes in movies that he just always knocks out of the park. And I guarantee, if you go to watch this movie, not only will you recognize him, but you'll know his name by the end of
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And it's the kind of coming out party performance that makes you realize how much of his career hasn't been wasted, But it's sort of like you look at his career and you realize people have been asking Picasso to paint bathrooms and woodsheds for the last 20 years. Like, for, he has never, outside of Oz and a few other things, been given the chance to stretch his wings like he does here.
Well, and, you know, it's, he definitely builds on previous performances he's used. Like, you can see he hasn't wasted the other things he does. Like, he has that little bit of charm and niceness under the surface that you see in, like, say, Juno. He's definitely got the hard edge that you would see in Oz and the physicality. You know, he uses every bag of tricks he has in this movie, and it he is, uses them well.
Like, a lot of times when people talk about an actor having range, a lot of time what they mean is sort of variance from performance to performance. J.K. Simmons has impeccable, incredible, almost unbelievable range, and you see every inch of that range in this film. Because there are moments, like, there are moments where you can see he's got a sort of fake niceness, and then there are scenes where you see him and he's genuinely nice, and then, like, a flip of the switch, he's back to that sort of provocative, poking sort of master over his student.
Yeah, he definitely is able to intimidate the hell out of everybody in that room.
And he is physically intimidating. Like, J.K. Simmons has got to be in his 50s or maybe early 60s. He is jacked and in this movie.
When you see those veins on the side of his head, he's got this one vein that just zigzags from, like, his temple to almost up to his forehead. It's just like,
yeah,
it's kind of scary.
The physicality is almost like a coiled snake. Like, his muscles are tense and ready to strike at any moment. And even the vein in the head shows that same thing. Like, he is restraining all this energy and power that can burst at any moment.
And it's also scary. You realize when he's slapping that kid in one part and he does it multiple times, you realize not only is this coming out of rage to get this kid to play better, but he's holding back. Holding back when he's doing it.
Because if he wanted to, he could knock that kid's head clean off.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say about this movie other than you should really see it.
J.K. Simmons won a well-deserved Golden Globe for this film, and I'd really like to see it pick up a couple more nominations along the way and hopefully a win or two.
Are you guys going to hold it over one more week?
We are holding it over, yes.
Okay, so you got at least one more week to see this movie.
There's no excuse.
Yeah, you really should see it. Like, forget about awards for a minute. It just should be seen.
This is art.
And see it in the best way you can, like up on the big screen.
Especially in a room with amazing sound.
Yeah.
The better sound system you have, the better quality of experience you're going to have.
Yeah, your brother kind of went off on how they mic'd up all the drums onto the surround sound. So they knew what they were doing when they mic'd up everything. I guess is my point.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we are now going to do our top 10 movie list for the year. This is for the Thin Men. This is not for me or for Zach. This is our combined
as
love.
A unit. We melded two lists together and jiggered some rankings around, and here we are.
Yeah, and if you're interested in knowing what we feel like on a top 10, maybe check out Montucky Skies in a week or two, and I'd imagine we'll be talking about these. So at number 10, we have, and bear with us, everybody who's not normally, if you're not normally the person who goes to big popcorn movies, just bear with us. It's number 10.
Give us like 3.5 minutes to just geek out for a second.
But if you haven't seen it, Guardians of the Galaxy is amazing.
I feel completely, like, I'm being completely honest when I say that is the most fun I had in a movie theater in 2014.
Yeah.
I did not have a more fun time at any other movie.
And I saw it twice. And I own the Blu-ray.
So people who are familiar with me from the other podcast know that this is the sort of movie I was waiting my whole life for, thinking would never come. And it delivered on every level.
And this is the sort of movie that I didn't think I wanted, but the movie that I needed.
We're just so in this world.
Yeah.
And Guardians of the Galaxy is out of this world. Nailed it. Transition out.
So to basically sum this movie up, it's basically the most fun Star Wars version of a movie you'll ever see. Yes. I mean, is that kind of fair to say?
Absolutely. This is like if Star Wars
had a big sense of humor.
Exactly. Had a playful, geeky sense of humor.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically about five people who don't belong together, should never be together.
No business knowing each other.
But wind up together and save the galaxy.
And become an adorable family along the way.
And some unsung heroes in this movie as well. John C. Reilly is so great in just the little scenes he has. Glenn Close is able to
bring some funness to it. Peter Serafinowicz has some fun.
Yeah.
It's nice to see Cosmo the space dog.
Howard the Duck.
And Howard the Duck. And Benicio del Toro having more fun than he's ever had in his career, playing essentially Space Liberace in an episode of Hoarders. Just visualizing it will make you crack up.
Yeah. Okay, so our number 9 on the list is very close to the fun factor.
Yes.
Me and Zach actually went to go see this movie together, 22 Jump Street.
Yes, by Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Yeah, okay. So here's the thing about this movie. So we went to watch this movie, and we were in this big crowd of people, and most people laughed at the really, you know, obvious sight gags.
Your butt jokes, your puke jokes, so on and so forth.
Yeah, but there is so much meta humor and commentary on how sequels are made that's just so clever and well done.
And so
and me and Zach were like alone laughing at these things.
I don't think we were laughing so much as cackling. Yeah. We sounded like evil witches in a silent theater.
And that's the great thing about this movie is I really think you could put five people in a room together and they'll all laugh and they'll all laugh at different jokes.
Exactly.
And the only movie I can think of that compares other than the first 21 Jump Street movie would be like The Graduate. Bear with me. There's every type of joke in The Graduate. You have like the lowball humor. You have the subtle humor. You have every kind of joke that you can think of in that movie. And I would put it up with that kind of movie. I mean, it really is really well done.
It's spectacularly well done. And here's the other reason this movie makes a list for me is degree of difficulty. So the degree of difficulty of pulling off a movie version of a cheesy 80s teen cop show is insane to begin with. Like, taking that premise and making it good is hard enough. Then to add the sequel factor on top of that and still find a way to be fresh and vibrant within it is so rare to see, especially in comedy.
Yeah. I would also say the things that really worked in the first film, they give you more of in this one, which I like.
Yes.
I mean, they clearly looked at the first one. They're like, we can do better. Here's how we'll do better. This is what worked.
Because the bones of the plot are essentially the same, but because the bones of the plot are essentially the same, that gives them even more to sort of comment on and wink at.
Yeah. Okay, so our number 8. So this is where we're still in popcorn fair, but yep, we're starting to get
we're
a little
evening
more
out of it.
Now, Zach didn't see this one quite yet, but that's right. I insisted it be on this list. Interstellar.
Directed by Christopher Nolan.
Yeah. Now, this movie is great. I remember watching the trailers for this and thinking, I don't know. Like, I knew I'd probably like it because it was Christopher Nolan, but it kind of looked dull from the trailers. Man, could not be further from the truth. A lot of people have talked about how Christopher Nolan has a difficult time portraying relationships and like emotions in his movies. He nails everything in this. I mean, the core of this movie is a relationship between a daughter and a father. And they find a way that brought tears to like me and my wife and my stepdaughter's eyes at the end of the movie. Like, they really are able to take that relationship and make it mean a lot. And it directly ties in with everything that's going. Like, essentially, you have a person who's got to save Earth. And the most important thing to log while they're doing this is time, because they're doing everything near a black hole. There's one scene in the movie, if I remember correctly, 1 hour on this planet equals 23 years on Earth. And so you can tell every time they make a misstep, it's just like, oh my God, you really feel it, because like now you're watching this girl go from a little girl to a middle-aged woman while he's off in space, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they really play at this relationship, but there's a lot of things with time. There's other elements I don't really want to give away unless you watch it. And the special effects are just astounding. I mean, on every level, this is a director at the top of his game, putting a top of his game movie out.
Now, I haven't seen this movie. I wholeheartedly support its place on this list for one reason alone. And that is because Christopher Nolan is the only human making movies like this. these gigantic movies that are based on original ideas and have the guts to go for it, to really try to do something out there that we haven't seen before. And so on ambition alone, it makes a list just because movies like this don't get made anymore. Like movies with the kind of budget and effects work and star power and time put into them get made if they're a franchise.
And let me be really clear. Movies with a budget this big aren't nearly as heady as this movie.
Mm-mm.
There is a lot to think about in this movie and to contemplate over. And the smarter you are, the more fun you're going to have in that movie. Because even Neil deGrasse Tyson loved it. Could not stop tweeting about it.
Like literally, he is still tweeting right now.
Yeah, I think he is. Okay, so a little more popcorn fare. And then I think we hit
we're
some
free and clear.
Yeah. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Now, I know what you're thinking. Okay, so you just put a movie that's a sequel to a movie that was a reboot to a movie that was a remake. Yes, that's how good this movie is. Andy Serkis, with the motion capture things that he does, is incredible. And that is the least amount of fanfare I can give this movie.
Yes.
Because it is great on every level. The story is amazing. I don't remember a Hollywood movie that I've ever seen that was a big budget summer movie that made me wince every time somebody died. I mean, this movie is a statement against violence, and it really does the job well.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking a case about why war is wrong and the bad things that can happen in war, and presenting both sides of everything, it's just amazing.
And also, rather than giving a black and white perspective, it's almost as if the characters in the film exist on a spectrum. From sort of pure evil in the blockbuster Hollywood sense of the word to pure good. And there's no one really truly on either extreme. They all represent points on that spectrum from one to the other.
And there's no character that you watch that you're like, oh, well, why would he go to that point? I don't understand that.
Exactly.
Like, you can understand the motivations that everybody's doing. And so I'll just keep it a little bit vague. But if you think that this is a terrible movie, you really should check it out. You don't even have to watch the other one.
No,
it stands alone for itself.
You need not have seen a single Planet of Apes.
Yeah, there's definitely things that if you see the first, I guess, reboot of the remake,
that will add to the experience to some degree.
But it's not needed. I mean, this film is made the way that movie should be, where it's self-contained. You can sit down and watch it, and you don't have to burden yourself with the history of these movies. But it's really, really a fine piece of cinema.
It's also one last thing I want to note, which is you mentioned Andy Serkis giving his best motion capture performance yet, and that's very true.
To the point where I almost don't want to say motion capture because
yeah, it's
you
just
really believe these characters.
The reason I do specify motion capture in this performance is we've seen Andy Serkis give amazing motion capture performances before. For the first time, another actor was able to bring that same level of gravitas to these performances. And that's a testament to the work of Andy Serkis, who has helped develop this technology. But it's also a testament to the work of the vastly underrated Toby Kebbell as the antagonist ape Koba.
Oh, yeah.
And he is every bit Caesar / Andy Serkis's equal in this movie, and it's stronger for it.
Okay, so at number 6, we've got Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel.
So this is the kind of movie that if you are not into Wes Anderson's aesthetic at this point, this is not going to be the movie to sell you at all. Because this is possibly the most Wes Anderson-y Wes Anderson movie yet.
Yeah, it is.
That being said,
it might as well be made out of tuba parts.
Exactly. Just tuba parts and pastel colored pencils.
Yeah. Now, I could go on about the plot, but I don't really remember the plot so well because I saw it around the time it first came out. But visually is stunning, like so stunning.
Striking.
That like, it was my favorite movie of the year when it came out. You know, up to that point, mm-hmm. It was my favorite. It's just, it's amazing. It's like a mirror in every scene, the way that they just frame everything. And I'm going to come out and say it. This dude needs to be up for best cinematographer. Whoever did this movie, he better get a nomination. Wouldn't necessarily be my choice to win, but he better be up for it because the way that they frame the shots in this movie is just incredible. I also like that there's things in this movie that show Wes Anderson's kind of grown as a director.
He coaxed something out of Ralph Fiennes in the lead that is wildly unexpected, which is to say that you go in seeing Ralph Fiennes and you expect a very good to great performance. What you don't expect is for Ralph Fiennes to be the comedic center of the film. Ralph Fiennes is not known for comedy.
No.
And he completely delivers. Like, his movements are funny. The way he sort of inhabits space is funny. His voice is funny. Like, everything about him is funny.
And I gotta give that to Wes Anderson.
Because, he coaxed it out of him.
Yeah, he coaxed it out of him, and he presented the movie in a way in which Ralph Fiennes' character would be hilarious in this movie. Yes,
absolutely.
So, yeah. So, definitely well-deserving at number six. And number five I didn't see, but Zach spoke so highly of it.
I'm taking the floor.
Yeah.
There's a case to be made that Tom Hardy is one of the five best actors currently working, if not the best. That case is called Locke. Directed by Stephen Knight. Now, Locke is, in a lot of ways, the antithesis in filming, the actual, like, logistics of filming to Boyhood. Whereas Boyhood was shot over 12 years, Locke is shot in 6 days. The film is exactly 90 minutes long, which is also the amount of time Tom Hardy's character's trip takes. Now, for those who are unfamiliar, this movie features one actor and then some voice actors, and it takes place solely inside of a car. The movie picks up immediately as Tom Hardy gets in his car and starts driving, and ends when he parks at his destination. And throughout that time, you sort of learn more and more about this character and why he's going where he's going and what drives him and what the core of his life are and what kind of man he is. And it deep dives into this person's life in a level you never see in a movie. Ivan Locke is a fully formed human being. Like, in every way, he's three-dimensional. He has... You learn about his hopes and his dreams and his fears and his successes and his failures and what he's great at and what he's terrible at. And you see it all within the span of this 90 minutes. And it's a stunning piece of work from Tom Hardy. The film was shot in 6 days, like I said. It would be shot with Tom Hardy entering the car and the other actors who call him over the phone all together in a hotel room. And they would get Tom Hardy in the car, and which was in the bed of a big semi truck, which allows them to get the angles they get. And they would start driving, and he would drive all the way down, go back and do it again twice every night, reciting the entire script from beginning to end in order without missing a beat, twice a night, every night for 6 days, allowing them to get so many angle, like camera angles. The cinematography is impressive just from the logistical challenge of what they're doing. But then when you see how many different angles they get, like, this is the kind of thing you'd expect would be a major, like, multi-month long Hollywood production, to get these kind of angles and that level of performance and the cuts they do. It's a masterwork on a lot of levels, but no more than Tom Hardy, who he does. I've always known Tom Hardy was great since the first thing I saw him in. He is at a new level here. Like, this is a Hall of Fame type performance.
So at number four, we've got the Jake Gyllenhaal. Can we say breakout? I know he's been big, but this seems like it's almost launched into another stratosphere the way people
I would
are
say
talking
it's
about
probably
it.
His critical breakout.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Now, this comes on a long string of great performances, starting with his performance in Zodiac and going through movies like Prisoners and Enemy and a few other things along the way. And this is sort of the apex. Much like I said with the Terrence Fletcher character in Whiplash, Lewis Bloom is a name I will not be forgetting anytime soon. I don't know about you, but this dude is going to haunt my thoughts and memory for a long time to come.
See, this movie, essentially, it strengthens what I've always felt about the media. So I used to live by Seattle. Like, I lived in Olympia, Washington. We used to get King 5, this Seattle news station. And it reminds me so much of it because it was just whatever bloody footage that they could find to put onto the news was their big thing. Child killed in a massacre. Details at 6.
There's
and
a I mean, line.
This movie really explores that dark nature.
Absolutely.
Of the news.
This is such a morally gross and icky and squicky movie. And Rene Russo, in a very welcome comeback, it's nice to see Rene Russo on all cylinders again, has a line that's in the film in most of the advertising, I think, as well, where she says, "Think of my news program as a woman holding a baby running down the street streaming with her throat cut." And that is exactly what this movie becomes.
Yeah. And there's been comparisons to Taxi Driver, which I can see with this movie, but it's not Taxi Driver. It's very much its own thing.
This is a gross, grimy...
Taxi Driver.
Yes,
too,
but it becomes psychotic, much like Taxi Driver was, but in a very different way.
Yeah, like I felt like Taxi Driver more explored a certain type of person and how that person could become famous for the wrong reasons. This is more about the person who glorifies violence on the news.
The way I think of it is if Taxi Driver. This character,
if Travis Bickle decided to film the news.
Well, yes. What I mean with this specific character is if Gordon Gekko, from that character from Wall Street, and Travis Bickle had a baby. Like, that is who this guy is. Like, he is in every way like an upwardly mobile, driven achiever, and a total underachiever, sort of squeamish, icky psychopath, all in the same body.
And I gotta say, because we are talking about the negative stuff about this movie, because it is a movie about a negative subject, there's a lot of humor to be mined.
A lot
out
of super dark
because
humor.
Because he's so awkward and so socially inept that it's kind of hilarious to, especially his back and forth with his partner.
Is always great.
Yeah.
And the stuff with Bill Paxton is a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Bill Paxton, like, kind of making a little bit of a comeback lately, too.
Yeah.
This movie could very well be called Comeback.
Yeah, right?
You would understand why they'd say it, but you'd be like, why did they go with that title,
this
though?
Thematically does not mesh with what I just witnessed.
Okay, so our number three movie, Gone Girl.
Gone Girl, Fincher.
Would you say this is Fincher's best movie? Because I would. And I love Fight Club, but just for how clever it is, kind of got to put it above Fight Club. It's definitely better than Alien 3.
You really put... Oh, yeah, no question.
I'd put it above Benjamin Button's
Panic Room. I need a little more time with this movie before I can go that far.
Okay.
My three favorite Fincher movies to this point were Fight Club, Seven, and Zodiac. And Gone Girl is right up there with those as the best.
Yeah,
the
Seven's
best work
pretty
of,
great, too.
It's right up there with the best work of Fincher's career. How it slots among those four, I need a little more time with to sort out.
But I've had enough time to decide it's my favorite Fincher movie.
Fair enough.
It's amazing.
It's a fantastic film. Rosamund Pike is a revelation.
Okay, now here's what I got to say really quick about this movie, because we're just doing these shallow little dives into what each one's about. We really can't tell you about what this movie is really about.
No.
Because if we told you, I would hate myself forever for ruining it for somebody.
Yes.
There are twists and turns in this movie you just have to watch, and there's no way you could predict where it's going to go.
Unless you have outside knowledge.
Yeah. Now, that being said, it says some very important things about our society.
Mm-hmm.
The acting is
top
fantastic.
Notch.
Like, first off, before we dive into the biggest achievement for the acting, let me say something about Ben Affleck. People need to stop it with the Ben Affleck hate.
Dude's good.
I know what he did before. I get it. Maybe there's some people who haven't seen Argo yet who aren't convinced. You need to see this movie. He is great in this movie. He does exactly what is needed, and he brings even more to it.
Absolutely.
He is able to put all the levels that need to be established for this movie to work. And Fincher clearly knew it, because I don't think Fincher would have put him in this movie if he wasn't capable of it. So you need to know, too.
Yes. And if Fincher believes in someone, then just by proxy, I also believe in them.
And by the way, clearly believes in Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, because they once again put out a great soundtrack for this movie.
Just killing it on every level.
And if you've seen the other movies they've scored, you probably know about how this movie sounds. It's like The Social Network or The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the American version.
Mm-hmm.
So it's on the level for that type of music, but it does really great scoring everything. But the real achievement in this movie, that like the creme de la creme of this movie.
The proof that David Fincher can get a great performance out of literally any human being.
Yeah, Rosamund Pike.
She's been very good in things in the past. She was hot fire in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, this is what happens when you take a very talented actor and let them off the leash.
Yeah. Now, this is another one I'll say, if she does not get a nomination, I am going to be
there will be riots.
Yeah. But man, I wouldn't be shocked if she got it off of what I've seen so far. She is incredible. And once again, without giving away anything in this movie, it's really tough to talk about her performance. But there are a lot of different things that she has to do in this movie, and she nails every one of them.
Yes. Now, there was something I said before you brought up Rosamund Pike, as you were bringing up, when I said proof that David Fincher can get a great performance out of anyone. I thought you were going somewhere different, which is to say Tyler Perry's good in this movie.
Yeah, he is.
And that's where I was going.
Was in it.
That's where I was going with the David Fincher can get a good performance out of anyone, because Tyler Perry is like the exact right amount of subtle and the exact right amount of scene chewing. Like, he's I mean, it's just
There's no Madea in this movie.
At all. And this is the kind of thing I did not think Tyler Perry was capable of. Like, I did not... This is... When I first heard he was going to be in the movie, it took me aback a little bit. I still trusted Fincher, but I was like, I just cannot see how Tyler Perry could exist in this world.
Yeah, this is another movie I saw the trailer and wasn't wild for, but I knew it was David Fincher, so I'm like, it's going to be a good movie. Yeah. It's just going to be...
And then when you see it, you learn why the trailer can't be
Tyler
great.
Perry was in it, and I was like, oh, no. But you're like, no, he doesn't ruin it. Yeah. He actually adds to it. And yeah. It's like, really? So that's another phenomenal achievement.
Yes, a lot of great achievement from directors on this list.
Okay, so number two, we're going to talk about not at all because we talked about it at the start of the show.
I only have one thing to say.
Yes.
Our number two, we should say, is Whiplash.
Yes.
Now, I know we were supposed to learn that the two words, good job, are the most harmful in the English language.
That's why we're going to say.
But Damien Chazelle.
Job.
You really busted your butt on this one. And I just want you to know somebody out there appreciates it.
Yeah. Okay. And so our number one movie, Birdman. Dude, I love Birdman.
Birdman's amazing.
We did a review, so I don't know how much we should go into it.
Yeah, people know how we feel about this movie. They know. I honestly think if we went back and listened to that conversation, I mean, that's all the reasons we put it number one right there. From a set design level, to a casting level, to a cinematography level, to a direction level, to
acting,
yeah. To a to a degree of difficulty level. Like, everything about this movie is perfect for what this movie is. Now, when I say this,
the special effects are also incredible. Amazing. The one scene they have it in, really.
Absolutely. Now, this, I will say, is a perfect movie. Now, when I say that, a lot of people, when you say perfect movie, means it must automatically be one of the best five or six movies of all time. And it can mean that. But when I say a perfect movie, what I mean is it achieved everything it set out to achieve and then some.
And there's no wasted opportunity.
There's no wasted opportunity. There's nothing that can be improved upon in this movie. Like, everything is as good as it can possibly get. And when you're firing on all cylinders like that, you create a masterpiece. And that's what Alejandro González Iñárritu did.
Okay. So I do want to talk about one thing we kind of glossed over on the last one was, so the entire soundtrack is done by this one drummer.
Yeah.
Who is great. Now, what would you say was better drumming? Would you say it was, or more captivating? Was it Birdman or was it Whiplash? It's tough.
I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I still can't really decide, because they both...
That says a lot about us that we both spent time thinking about
deeply
this.
And it's the reason I can't totally decide, and it's one of those things where on any given day when you asked me, the answer probably changes. But the thing that really jumped out to me about Birdman's score, the drumming score, is that it was so... It felt very fluid and free, and it was sort of unpredictable and unexpected in that way. Whereas the Whiplash drumming, while equally great, is also very much, like, outside of the soloing and fills, is very much a more sort of straightforward jazz drumming.
Yeah, you picked the right answer. Because Birdman is better drumming because it scores an entire movie
that
and
too,
does
yeah.
it so great.
And it's the thing that, when you listen to just drums in a recording, the thing that can really be lost is a sense of dynamic, like a sense of sort of volume dynamics and pacing dynamics and emotional dynamics. And Birdman's score has that in spades. Like, even though the sort of basic sound is the same from track to track in the score, it feels different within each scene.
And he probably did it off a 9-piece drum kit. So it's not like he had timpanis off to the side. It was able to, like,
he's not using a wind chime or anything like that. No. There's no wood blocks on this kit.
There's no cowbell.
Mm-mm.
No.
Although, I wouldn't have said no to a little cowbell. I'm just kidding, of course.
You know, I love it the way it is. So
it's a phenomenal achievement in filmmaking. And this is one that I feel confident I can say will get nominated for Best Picture.
Yep.
Will get nominated for Best Actor.
Let's be honest. There's no chance that Michael Keaton doesn't get nominated for Best Actor.
Now, you want to hear
something?
He's
the darling right now, and it's about acting. Mm-hmm. There's no way this
isn't
up. There's
a 0% chance he doesn't get nominated.
And I think we both agree when we talk about it, even though we haven't necessarily seen everything that's going to be nominated yet.
Mm-hmm.
I still feel like he's the favorite.
He's my front runner as well.
Yeah.
He's absolutely.
Now we'll see what happens. He may, something may come out where he murders a child with his car or something.
or somebody else just might become the darling. Like maybe they decide in these last couple of weeks that before when
maybe somebody saves like a child from Michael Keaton exactly. running over him.
Something happens. But until then, now this is something that I think will upset you. I don't think you know this.
Okay.
The score was ruled ineligible for best original score.
That is terrible. Why?
Mm-hmm. Because there were segments that were based on a composition the drummer and composer had already done in the past, despite the fact that they were original and not released separately. It technically made it ineligible, which is baloney, but here we are.
I think that was a reason why the score for that Coen Brothers remake of...
True Grit.
Yeah, that was why True Grit's soundtrack was also
ineligible.
Yeah.
And it's always a shame when something that is... Like, this score is truly original, and it's a shame that it won't be recognized for that.
Yeah, they better at least have it up for a song or something, but it'll probably be like five pop stars.
It'll be like three songs from Annie. It'll
be something Bruce Springsteen
Let
does.
It Go will be nominated for the second year running.
Just because they love it so
That's
much.
That's right.
Somehow Pharrell will get in there.
Exactly. Sure. Like, we know how this is going to play out. Well, that's our top 10. I'm sure everyone agrees 100% down the line and does not have a single quibble with our list.
Even though we both don't necessarily agree
with our list.
That's just our culminative list.
That's right.
We can agree with.
But I'm sure no listener will feel like we left anything off. And I'm sure no listener will feel like anything was in the wrong order. Everyone will completely agree.
Can I leave one final thought with this?
Hit it.
We both wanted to add Captain America 2, but we felt embarrassed about
That's
it.
Right.
So it's an honorable mention. So thank you once again for joining us. Whiplash will be held over and playing at the Myrna Loy for a little while.
That's right.
And coming up soon, Mark Cohn will be playing over at the Myrna Loy too. So.
Sadly, the show is sold out. And for those wondering what we might be talking about in the future, Foxcatcher opens on Friday.
So stay listening.
Thanks for coming out to meet me. I've just been so down lately.
No problem, man. What's the matter?
It's so hard to talk about. My batting average isn't quite what it used to be.
Your batting average?
My drive shaft doesn't have the kind of torque I'm looking for, if you catch my drift.
So you're feeling some depression from your erectile dysfunction?
Some. I'm only feeling depression from my erectile dysfunction.
You know, it's something that helps me is the Not Safe for Network.
The Not Safe for Network? What's that?
Not Safe for Network.
Side effects include rule birds, best available, we have a good life, Monk of the Skies, Fox Office Battle, Thin Men, and shooting the show. Do not take Not Safe for Network if you're on Cialis, Viagra, On Legend, or Comedy Central commercials at 4 a.m.
Not Safe for Network.
Wow, my whole world is new. Thanks, Not Safe for Network.
Not Safe for Network, putting the function back in erectile dysfunction.
Not Safe for Network.